All right, so this is Bio 241, and it's Tuesday evening, November 18th, and I still intend to upload two figures, two exam figures that weren't, that are in your exam figure list, but weren't put on the internet. One was a sarcomere with the different bands, but I put an alternate one up there, so you'll be able to transpose the one that you have to the exact exam figure, no problem. And then there's another one that got left off of the print list. It's on your list, but I didn't put the JPEG online, so I'll put that JPEG online. I can't remember which one it is. 12.8. That's on your list to know, but I didn't put the JPEG up. Oh, it's the wrong one. Yeah, that's the sarcomere, I think. The sarcomere. So I'll make sure, and then I'll send an email to everybody that I have that up there. Okay. So if you're concerned about those exact figures, I have the list down in my office. I'll get it after class, before lab.
Okay.
Well, I'll put it online. I'll put it online probably tonight.
So which one is
it? I don't know. I have the list in my office, so I can bring it up right before lab. Okay, so we were talking about excitation-contraction coupling, and don't forget, when you stimulated a muscle in lab, the muscle didn't contract immediately, because with that experiment that you did, you were able to measure the stimulus, the electrical event, but you were also able to measure the physical event. That meant the tension when the muscle actually started to contract. So there are two different kinds of events. One is developed tension and the other is electrical, and they didn't happen at exactly the same time. And the electrical event always preceded contraction, right? So the electrical event is the signal for contraction. And what do we call that delay period between the stimulus and when the muscle actually starts to contract? The latent period. So how would you explain a latent period? What's happening during this latent period? How come there is this time delay between when the muscle is stimulated and when it actually contracts? What's happening there? What's actually happening? So let's say you stimulated the muscle cell directly. You didn't stimulate the nerve into sending an action potential, but you directly stimulated the muscle with electrical current. All right, so the whole muscle depolarizes. That sends an action potential over the surface of the muscle cell. Right, so that travels over the muscle cell. That action potential travels pretty fast. It's not a myelinated fiber, but it still travels probably at least 100 meters per second. That's still pretty fast because of the voltage-gated channels in the membrane. And that, where does that depolarization go besides the surface of the cell? Where does that action potential... on a muscle cell, where does that action potential go? Okay, that's normally where it would start. It would normally start at the motor end plate, but we bypassed that by putting an electrode right on the muscle cell and stimulated the muscle cell directly. Okay, so that electrode we put on the muscle cell is acting like a motor end plate. So that triggers all these voltage-gated channels, and that sends an action potential over the cell membrane. So besides the sarcolemma, where else does that action potential travel? Okay. Yeah, there are ligand-gated channels, for instance, when the neurotransmitter, what's the neurotransmitter of the neuromuscular junction? Acetylcholine. Yeah, we'll bind to that ligand-gated channel that will cause an action potential. But, you know, we bypass that because we stimulated the muscle directly with an electrical signal. All right, so that causes all these voltage-gated sodium channels to open, and then that's self-propagating over the surface of the cell membrane. That's what we call an action potential. So an action potential will flow over the whole cell membrane on the outside of the cell. But where else does that action potential flow to? That's what I'm looking for, right? So not only does it flow over the surface of the cell, but it goes deep inside the cell. And how does that action potential get deep inside the muscle cell? Via the T-tubules, right? The transverse tubules. So let's see if I can go back, right? So here's the surface of the cell. And the action potentials go even to the interior of the cell via these T-tubules. That's something that doesn't happen with nerve fibers because a nerve fiber doesn't have T-tubules. But muscle cells do. So here is that transverse tubule. And you can see that there are voltage-gated sodium channels, right? There's transverse tubules. In the transverse tubule, there are voltage-gated calcium channels. And then there are calcium release channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So when the transverse tubule voltage-gated calcium channel triggers, that pulls on the calcium channel in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It's a mechanically coupled system. It just pulls on, just like when you open a door, what are you doing? You're pulling on it, right? So these proteins pull on each other, and it opens up these calcium channels. And in skeletal muscle, sarcoplasmic reticulum is a reservoir for calcium. So there's high calcium here and low calcium in the myofibril. When those channels open, calcium diffuses out. So what can you tell me about the rate of calcium diffusion as it relates to concentration gradient? It goes from high to low. And if the concentration gradient is large, what about the rate of diffusion as opposed to if the concentration gradient is small? Yeah, it goes faster. That's right. So the rate of diffusion is directly related to the concentration gradient. And because there are calcium pumps that use ATP that are constantly pumping calcium into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, there's a huge concentration gradient. So when these channels open, calcium diffuses out, and I would like for you to tell me at what rate. Is it a slow rate or is it a fast rate? It's a fast rate. Why is it a fast rate? Because the concentration gradient is high. The sarcoplasmic reticulum is loaded with calcium. All right. So it moves out pretty fast. And then what does it do? It binds to troponin. That gets tropomyosin out of the way. Cross bridges can start to cycle, and that causes the sliding of the myofilaments. So all of this takes time. Right? Even though there's a large concentration gradient for calcium, with the initial stimulus of that muscle to when the filaments start to slide past each other, there are a number of steps, and that takes time to develop. And so that's what produces the latent period that you saw in lab. Okay. So I wanted to go over that. So calcium diffuses from the sarcoplasmic reticulum to troponin to initiate cross-bridge cycling and sliding of the myofilaments. When action potential ceases, the muscle relaxes. And why is that? And that's because, let's go back, that's because these calcium channels close, and what is always active in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum? The calcium pumps, taking it out of the myofibril, and then calcium will dissociate from troponin, tropomyosin will cover up the active sites on actin, and the muscle can't sustain the contraction anymore, and because of the elastic properties of muscle, it's going to go back to its resting length. So what part of the sarcomere has elastic properties that will cause the sarcomere to go back to its initial resting length? That's a molecule, the protein molecule called titin. Right? So titin doesn't pull, it doesn't make muscle tension. That's due to sliding of the filaments, but it produces the elastic property of the sarcomere. Okay. All right, so muscle relaxes because calcium is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so here is what a muscle twitch looks like. And a skeletal muscle, once stimulated at the neuromuscular junction, the action potential will flow over the whole cell down deep into the myofibrils. And that muscle, that single muscle cell will contract to its complete ability to do that. Okay? And the reason why you can, why is it that you can grade contraction? Or why is it that you can grade tension of a whole muscle, like a biceps brachii? If every time you stimulate a single cell, it contracts to its whole capability, 100%. How is it that every time you contract the biceps, it doesn't contract maximally? Because your brain figures out how many muscle fibers should be excited to produce the kind of contraction that you are expecting to produce. Right? So your brain kind of figures this out ahead of time by looking at the object that you're trying to lift, for instance. And we call that what? Recruitment of motor units. So more muscle fibers contract if you're trying to lift something heavy. If you're lifting something very light, only a few muscle cells will contract to produce a smaller amount of tension. Okay. But we do notice that a single rapid contraction and relaxation of a muscle fiber is what we call a twitch. So here is a single twitch right here. And if we apply a second stimulus right at this point in time, before the first twitch completely dies away, so the muscle is still producing tension. So this is a plot of tension versus time. This is not electrical activity, but this is tension produced by the muscle versus time. If the muscle hasn't completely relaxed by the time we stimulate it again, what can you tell me about the peak tension between the first time it was stimulated and the second time it's stimulated? Are they exactly the same? No, the second time is greater. So we call that summation. Okay, and if we do it a third time, it might even be higher the third time around. So contractions vary with strength. We can call these graded contractions. So that can be obtained by stimulating various numbers of muscle fibers. But how can we explain summation, maybe even within a single muscle fiber itself? So what's the signal for sliding of the myofilaments? It needs ATP for energy, but that's not the signal. What is the molecular signal that causes sliding of the myofilaments past each other or over each other? Calcium, that's right. Okay, so it takes time for those calcium pumps to pump all the calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So if we stimulate that muscle again, there's still some residual calcium in the myofibril. It's still producing a little bit of tension. And when there's another stimulus that releases more calcium on top of whatever residual is left over, and that produces summation. The second twitch is even at a little bit higher strength. Okay. So, but the frequency of stimulation has to be fast enough to where that calcium doesn't get all pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, and that would explain why the third stimulus would produce a higher peak compared to the second one. All right, so here we have a plot again of produced tension, developed tension versus time. And we have a muscle, and we're going to increase the frequency of stimulation on this muscle. So it's tension, we'll summate. All right, here's the first stimulus. The second stimulus is higher because there's some residual calcium still left in the myofibril, hasn't all been pumped back yet. And the third stimulus is going to produce even a little bit more tension, on and on and on, until we reach a level where the myofibril, right, all the troponin is bound to calcium. And there's enough calcium to where troponin is never really without calcium. So cross-bridge cycling is at a maximum. So it is completely saturated. That produces this level right here. This is what we call incomplete tetanus, because the muscle is still relaxing a little bit because the frequency of stimulation is still not high enough. All right, that's what we call incomplete tetanus. But if we increase the frequency of stimulation, say from 5 shocks per second to 60 shocks per second, okay, notice what happens. The muscle contracts, it sums very quickly, and it reaches a plateau, and the muscle never relaxes. None of the fibers in the muscle ever can relax because calcium is in the myofibril. It's never pumped out fast enough. This is what we call complete tetanus. Right? And then after a certain period of time, if that muscle is kept in a contracted state, we see that the tension starts to decrease, even though we're still stimulating it. What do you think could cause this fatigue? How come the tension is disappearing? How come the muscle can't, like if I gave you a 100-pound sack of potatoes and you're able to hold it up with one arm, right, you could hold it up for a couple minutes, and then what's going to happen? Oh, yeah, your arm is going to start to relax, and that sack of potatoes is going to end up on the floor. What's happening to that muscle? Even though you're telling that muscle to contract, it just can't anymore. What's happening there? Okay. So you could think, oh, well, maybe it's the neuromuscular junction. You know, but that recovers so fast, the neuromuscular junction hardly ever runs out of acetylcholine. So it's really not due to acetylcholine. but it has to do with the metabolism inside the muscle cell itself. So you remember that in order for cross bridges to cycle, it needs a calcium signal, but it also needs energy.
ATP.
It needs ATP. That's right. Okay. So when a muscle is contracted, right, it just turns into this big, huge, solid mass. Blood can't get into it when a muscle is contracted. And what is blood bringing to that muscle? It's bringing, we didn't get to that chapter yet, it's bringing oxygen. And what is that oxygen doing? It's going to an organelle. What organelle is it going to?
Mitochondria,
because mitochondria need oxygen for oxidative phosphorylation to make a lot of ATP for muscle contraction. But if oxygen isn't getting in there, then the only way that muscle cell can generate ATP is from what? Lactate fermentation. It's going to produce a lot of lactic acid. So a couple things are happening here. ATP is going away. The energy supply for muscle contraction, that's going down. Lactic acid is going up, but lactic acid is also an acid, so the pH is changing. So you got pH changes, you got buildup of lactic acid, you got depletion of ATP. You even have the buildup of ADP that might inhibit the muscle. So there are a number of biochemical compounds that build up when a muscle is contracting and causes fatigue. Not a psychological fatigue, but a real fatigue in this muscle. Okay. All right, so that's what real fatigue is as opposed to psychological fatigue. All right. Furthermore, how does that muscle feel when you're telling it to contract and it's not getting oxygen? And pH is going which way?
Down.
Yeah, don't forget, when it becomes more acidic, the pH goes down. It's the other way. When lactic acid builds up, how does that muscle feel?
Tired,
lazy, sort of. You're being really nice. Maybe we didn't talk about this yet. It hurts. Actually, it does what? It hurts like hell, right? Because have you ever had a muscle cramp? Maybe you're walking down the sidewalk, all of a sudden you get a muscle cramp in a leg muscle or something. Or maybe you're carrying some books or a backpack and you get a cramp in your biceps right here. And when that muscle just contracts like that and you can't cause it to relax, you say, oh, wow, look at that nice big muscle right there. Do you walk around showing that big muscle off that's in a cramp? Or what are you doing? No, you're doing everything you possibly can to get that thing relaxed, right? Because it hurts like hell. All right, so when you cut off oxygen to an exercising muscle, it hurts like hell. And that's true for skeletal muscle. That is true for smooth muscle. That's true for cardiac muscle. So when people have a heart attack, what's happening there? They're losing oxygen supply to their heart because maybe a blockage of a coronary artery. And can the heart take a break? No, it's going to keep contracting, and it's going to be using up ATP, producing ADP, producing lactic acid, pH is dropping. So how does it feel when somebody's having a heart attack? It hurts like hell, right? And as a matter of fact, a lot of people die when they're having a heart attack because it feels so bad that they are sure they're going to die, and they just kind of give up, right? So the important thing, if you have a loved one having a heart attack, get them to the hospital, keep them calm, and tell them, you know, we'll fix you. And that might get them through it just by giving them some psychological support. Okay. There's another couple conditions. For instance, there is a blood condition called sickle cell anemia. And sickle cell anemia is a congenital condition that you inherit. And in this condition, your red blood cells, under certain conditions, can't carry oxygen to your tissues. And they form weird shapes. We're going to look at blood coming up pretty soon. And so oxygen isn't getting to your tissues. So somebody that's in sickle cell crisis, that's like having a muscle cramp all over your body. How does that feel? Oh, hurts like hell all over their body. So it's a really unfortunate, terrible condition to have. And you have to treat that condition, okay, with transfusions and fluids. And what do we do for people that are in agonizing pain? Opiates. Yeah, opiates or morphine. All right, so that kind of patient definitely deserves that kind of medication. What's another condition? Hurts like hell. When smooth muscle contracts and goes into spasm. Okay? Labor. Okay. Maybe if you're having a gallbladder attack with a bile duct that's occluded, that smooth muscle is going to contract. Or urinary tract blockage in the ureter, for instance, that's going to cause spasm in that smooth muscle, right? Or even what? Maybe even menstrual cramps during a cycle when the uterus contracts. How does that feel? Well, that's not exactly what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say it what? Hurts like hell. Okay, so these muscles need oxygen to produce ATP because otherwise they're going to fatigue. Okay, let's talk about different kinds of contraction. We can say that there are basically two kinds. There's isotonic and isometric contractions. Isotonic tells you everything you need to know about this particular condition. Isotonic, iso means what? Staying the same. And tonic refers to tension. So this is a kind of contraction where the tension in that muscle is constant, but the length is changing. So what does a muscle usually do when it's stimulated? What happens to the length? It shortens, it contracts, right? So isotonic means that the muscle is shortening, but the tension is remaining the same. So what's a good example of an isotonic contraction? Maybe if I have my hand open like this, and then I just flex my fingers, my digits, like that. The tension isn't changing in these muscles of my fingers, but certainly my fingers are flexing as a result of that. All right? But let's just say now it's Thanksgiving and I have a walnut, and I need to crack the walnut to eat the nut that's on the inside. So let's put a walnut inside my hand. So I close my fingers around the walnut, right? That's an isotonic contraction until I touch the walnut. But when I touch the walnut, what do I need to do to break the walnut? I got to start squeezing, right? Harder and harder and harder. But during that time, when I'm squeezing the walnut, are my muscles changing length? Are my fingers moving? Are they flexing anymore? No, I'm just increasing the tension. So that's what we call an isometric exercise. Isometric is when the muscles don't change length, but the tension, the developed tension, increases. That's an isometric contraction. So isotonic, the length changes, but the tension doesn't. Isometric, the tension changes, but the length doesn't. Those are the two. Okay. And then there's a third kind that's kind of interesting, and that is what we call an eccentric contraction. An eccentric contraction is when a muscle is stimulated into contract, but the length of the muscle actually gets longer. And we do that all the time, for instance, when you're walking down a flight of stairs. Okay, there are muscles that are contracting so that you just don't fall down the stairs, but they, even though they're contracted, they're lengthening to let you walk, all right, in a nice controlled fashion down the stairs. So your book uses an example of when somebody's lifting some weights, right? If you're bench pressing some weights, you could let the weights just fall on your neck, okay, but you probably don't want that to happen. You want to hold the weights up and do what? Let them lower gently down. So, for instance, your triceps and latissimus dorsi, they're contracting, but not so much that they're still stretching. That's what we call a lengthening contraction. And that actually is the most strenuous, and that can even be damaging to skeletal muscle. A lengthening contraction is damaging to muscle. So, any of you that are inclined to go walking around outside, maybe walk up a mountain or something, do some climbing. It's rougher to go up the mountain on your respiratory and cardiovascular system, right? And it's easier to walk down the mountain on your cardiovascular system and your lungs, but it's harder on your muscles because it's a lengthening contraction. So walking downhill is actually kind of harder in terms of your musculoskeletal system than actually walking uphill because of these eccentric contractions. All right, so tendons, connective tissue, have elastic properties. They absorb that tension as a muscle contracts. So when a muscle starts to contract, if it's connected to a tendon, it doesn't produce tension on a bone right away because the muscle has to take up the elastic properties of the tendons. All right, and then these tendons recoil as the muscle relaxes and spring back to its resting length. Okay, so here's something that I couldn't tell you much about until we learned something about a sarcomere, and this is the length-tension relationship in muscles. So the strength of a muscle contraction is influenced by a number of things. We saw that it's influenced by the frequency of stimulation because of summation. As we increase the frequency of summation, it slowly reaches plateau, which is what we call tetanus. And also, it depends on the thickness of each muscle fiber, right? So a muscle fiber is a muscle. So if we increase the diameter of a muscle fiber, what do you have more of inside that muscle? What's the organelle inside of a muscle fiber that's specialized for shortening? These big long tubes filled with myofilaments. If you put a bunch of myofilaments together, what do you get inside of a muscle fiber? You get the myofibril, right? So if the muscle fiber is bigger, you have more myofibrils all over that cell. You got more myofibrils, that means that muscle fiber can contract with more tension. All right, so I think that's pretty intuitive. The one that may not be so intuitive is this last one right here, and that is the initial length of this muscle fiber helps determine the strength of contraction. And this is very important even in terms of cardiac muscle and how we treat cardiac patients. So you really want to pay attention to this. Okay, the length-tension relationship. So the ideal resting length is that which can generate the maximum force. So when a muscle is not contracted, okay, that's when we say it's relaxed, depending on the length or the amount of stretch in that muscle will determine how much tension it can develop when it does start to contract. All right, so let's see how we can describe how that works. Okay, and the way that we understand how that works is by looking at a sarcomere and looking at the overlap between actin and myosin. Because how do you explain, what's the model that you have in your mind for shortening of a sarcomere? Yeah, you don't say, oh, the myosin gets shorter, because does it? No. You can't say, oh, the actin gets shorter, does it? No. Actin and myosin just slide over each other, right, for shortening of a sarcomere. So here is a plot of the relative tension produced by a muscle when it's stimulated into contraction versus the percent resting length. All right, so notice that it's zero. The amount of tension when it's stimulated is zero. When it's 60%, it's rest length, which means what? 60% means that it is shorter than its normal resting length. And over here, it's really stretched out already. Okay, so we stretch that muscle out. So what does a sarcomere look like? Well, this condition right here is when the muscle has been shortened. So what happens to the Z-lines when a muscle shortens? They come closer together, right? And now the sarcomere is so short that it really is the length of the myosin molecule, right? So, and can this sarcomere shorten anymore? It can't, right? Because it can't slide. The Z lines can't come closer anymore. So the sliding filament mechanism really shows us something nice about this length tension relationship. All right, if we go to the opposite end, when we stretch the muscle, all right, if we pull the Z disc farther and farther apart, notice that the myosin and actin filaments now don't overlap, but in order for cross-bridge cycling to take place, the myosin and actin have to overlap. Myosin has to be able to reach up and grab actin, but when the cross bridges reach up to grab actin, if there's nothing there to grab hold of, guess what? No sliding can take place. There's no contraction in that particular example, right? So muscles work best when there is an optimal overlap between actin and myosin. There has to be sufficient sites where myosin can form cross bridges, but there still has to be room for the sarcomere to shorten. And so you see a nice optimal region right here that relates to its, what, resting length, okay? And so that's what we call the length-tension relationship. If the muscle cell is too short, it doesn't produce a lot of tension. If it's too long, it can't produce tension just because of the overlap between actin and myosin. All right, what about neural control? Motor neurons go down from the ventral horn of the spinal cord. Axons leave the ventral root. You're familiar with all this stuff. These are called lower motor neurons, and that's the final common pathway that sends efferent signals to that effector organ. Upper motor neurons go from the cerebral cortex, right? I don't know if you can picture this, down through the internal capsule, down the spinal cord, to this region in the ventral horn of the spinal cord gray matter. So it takes two neurons to get to an effector neuron from your cerebral cortex. The first one is the upper motor, the lower one that leaves and goes into the peripheral system, that's the lower motor neuron. This pathway and the activity in this pathway is influenced by sensory feedback from both muscles and tendons. All right, and sometimes it can be facilitatory, sometimes it can be inhibitory from the upper motor neurons. All right, so let's see what can be involved with this. Well, feedback is important because it will tell your central nervous system if the muscle is contracting properly. All right, and if it's not, it's going to produce an error signal, and then the central nervous system will do something to correct for that error. All right, so we have a couple sensory organs in our skeletal system that can measure muscle length or stretch, and that's called a muscle spindle apparatus. These are what we find in skeletal muscles. And then there are things that measure tension, and these are in tendons. We call these Golgi tendon organs. So these are the two main kinds of organs that help send information back to the central nervous system, telling your central nervous system if your skeletal muscles are behaving. So the first one is the spindle apparatus. The other one is the Golgi tendon. So here is a muscle spindle apparatus. It's not drawn to scale because you can never see these things with your naked eye. You would need a microscope to see them. And you can see nerves going to the spindle apparatus. And the spindle apparatus, the zoomed in region, is right here. So here is the usual kind of muscle cell that you're aware of. So this is what we call an extrafusal fiber. The extrafusal fiber is the kind of fiber that produces tension when stimulated, right, that allows you to lift something up. And extrafusal fibers are innervated by alpha motor neurons that tell that whole muscle to contract. And inside this capsule right here is the muscle spindle. This is the thing that's measuring the tension that's being produced by these extrafusal fibers. The fibers inside the spindle apparatus are what we call intrafusal fibers. Intrafusal fibers. And they are innervated not by alpha motor neurons, but by gamma motor neurons, another kind of motor neuron. So both of these muscles can be stimulated into contraction. The extrafusal fibers contract with a lot of power. They can generate force. Contraction of the intrafusal fibers don't generate tension. Okay, so what kind of contraction generates tension? Is it an isotonic or an isometric contraction? Isometric produces tension. The isotonic keeps tension the same. Okay, so these produce isotonic contractions. They don't help lift anything, but they can contract. And you'll see why that is in just a second. All right, so these are efferent neurons. The alpha and the gamma are efferent, that cause stimulation, that cause these muscles to contract. All right, but the intrafusal fibers also have sensory organs on them that send information back to the central nervous system. All right, the intrafusal fibers have a couple different, there are a couple different types of intrafusal fibers. The one in the center right here is what we call a nuclear bag fiber, because all the nuclei are kind of randomly arranged in the center of this cell. The ones on the periphery of the spindle apparatus are what we call the nuclear chain fibers, because the nuclei are lined up in a nice linear fashion that kind of looks like a chain. And the sensory organs are a little bit different as well. Okay, so the sensory organs on the nuclear bag fiber are what we call the annulospiral nerve endings. And the nerve endings or the sensory apparatus in the nuclear chain fibers are what we call the flower spray endings. So these give us a couple different kinds of information. Okay. The annulospiral organs respond most to the onset of stretch. That's these right here. All right. And the flower spray endings right over here respond to sustained stretch. So this is the onset and this is sustained stretch, but both respond very strongly to rapid stretching. Okay, their activation causes what we call a reflex contraction of the muscle. Okay, so how on earth does this work? Okay, so the muscle spindle apparatus is to send information back to the central nervous system about the proper degree of tension produced by the extrafusal fibers, right? The extrafusal ones are doing most of the work. The interfusals are just there to monitor what's happening. Okay. So what happens is, or I gotta probably go to this slide right here, both the intrafusal fibers and extrafusal fibers are stimulated to contract together. We call that co-activation of the alpha and gamma motor neurons. All right, so what does that do? That causes the extrafusal fibers to contract and the intrafusal fibers to contract. All right, so now they both have the same length, so that if the extrafusal fibers start to stretch, since there is already some tension on the intrafusal fibers, they start to stretch as well. And that information is passed up through these primary and secondary nerve fibers to the central nervous system to cause the extrafusal fibers to contract to prevent the muscle from stretching even further. All right, so let's see if I can figure out a way how to show you this. Co-activation. So let's just say blue from here to here is an intrafusal fiber, and the black is going to be extrafusal. So extrafusal and intrafusal. And right now they have the same length. Okay, but now you want to undergo some kind of motion. What is going to be stimulated first? What's going to produce tension in a muscle? Is it going to be the extrafusal or intrafusal fiber? It's going to be the extrafusal fibers. These are the ones that produce tension. All right, so what's going to happen to them? They're going to shorten. All right, when they start to contract. Now, if the intrafusal fibers weren't co-activated at the same time, okay, what's going to happen to them? They're going to stay the same length, but they're embedded in this muscle, so they're going to have, all right, their endpoints are going to shorten, but they're going to be the same length. What's going to happen to them? All right, there's going to be a lot of slack in that muscle right there, right, because now it's the same length, but it's in a shorter distance. All right, so now there's no tension whatsoever in this muscle, in the intrafusal fibers. So if in this condition, if all of a sudden we started to stretch the extrafusal fiber, what would happen to the tension, okay, in the intrafusal fiber? Well, you know what? There's so much slack right here that it couldn't measure any stretch. It couldn't measure any stretch until what happened? This extrafusal fiber got to this length and then started to stretch past that point. But at that point, there might already be damage to the muscle itself. Okay, so the reason why there is co-activation, so this doesn't happen, co-activation means that the extrafusal fiber contracts. It's going to cause contraction of the intrafusal fiber. So now that there is proper tension in the intrafusal fiber, so as soon as we start to stretch the muscle, what does this intrafusal fiber feel? It feels stretching. And it sends that signal to the central nervous system. In this case right here, when the muscle starts to stretch, this intrafusal fiber can't feel any stretching because it's so loose in there. Right? So co-activation makes sure that the intrafusal fibers can send tension information back to the central nervous system. And let's just see how that can protect your body. Okay. So that's kind of just what I said right here. So let's look at the monosynaptic stretch reflex first. Slide number 70. It consists of only one synapse within the central nervous system. Okay, so here we have somebody's lower appendage. And we can see the nice rectus femoris muscle right here connected to the patellar tendon, which inserts into the patella, and then the patella, of course, has a ligament, the patellar ligament, that goes to the tibial tuberosity. And when this rectus femoris applies tension, it's transmitted through the patellar ligament into the tibial tuberosity. So if we take a little hammer, did you guys do this in class? Probably? Tonight? Okay. You can tap that patellar tendon, and when you tap it, that places additional tension on that tendon. It's going to try to, or ligament, and it's going to try to stretch the ligament, but that impulse of tension on this ligament pulls on the patella, that pulls on the tendon, which pulls on the muscle, and what's going to happen to the muscle when you pull on it? It's going to stretch. Okay. But because of coactivation between the spindle apparatus and the extrafusal fibers right here, as soon as you stretch the muscle, what happens to the spindle apparatus? When you stretch the extrafusal fibers, because of coactivation, the intrafusal fibers are the same length, they stretch as well. And because of the nerve endings in the spindle apparatus, that sends action potentials back to the central nervous system saying that the muscle is stretching. And that's something you don't want to happen because that could damage a joint or something. So, okay, so you have the sensory neurons coming up, right, from the spindle apparatus into the spinal cord, and that's, of course, the dorsal root. You're going past the dorsal root ganglia, right, and synapsing directly on this motor neuron. Now, this is the alpha motor neuron, not the gamma motor neuron, and the sensory neuron is going to inhibit the alpha motor neuron. So how could you explain inhibition of this alpha motor neuron? It's going to produce an... What's it going to produce? What kinds of stimulation on neurons are you familiar with? You've heard of EPSPs? Okay, what does an EPSP do? Causes? It's excitatory, produces depolarization. And what's another kind? IPSPs, right? So this sensory neuron is going to produce IPSPs on this alpha motor neuron, which are going to inhibit it. It's going to decrease the number of action potentials or block them altogether. And that's going to cause, wait. No, I'm wrong. Okay, hold on.
Oh, no.
Yeah, hold on. We got to rewind the tape. This synapse right here is excitatory. All right, so when this muscle starts to stretch, right, that sends afferent signals into the spinal cord, and that produces EPSPs on this alpha motor neuron, which does what? Stimulates this motor neuron. It sends action potentials to the muscle, and what's the muscle going to do then? It's going to contract, right? So this produces EPSPs, and it contracts, protecting this limb from stretching when this happens. So this is just a monosynaptic, or what we call the knee-jerk reflex. Okay, so this is an excitatory synapse right here. Stretching stimulates the spindle apparatus, which stimulates the alpha motor neuron, which causes contraction of the rectus femoris, which then protects this limb. Okay, so both the annual spiral and the nuclear bag fibers are stimulated with this kind of activity. Okay, now that takes me to the second kind of reflex. That's not due to muscle spindles, but this is due to the other proprioceptor or proprioceptor that we have in skeletal muscle. And this is what we have in tendons. We call these Golgi tendon organs. They monitor tension. All right, so as, let's just say, I had a little container. I said, here, hold on to this for me. Well, I do something and then I want it back. Maybe it's like that little container right over there, the little Tupperware container. And you hold on to it, okay? And I say, thanks, but how about I sort of trick you and that container right now has got air in it, but let's just say that I had a bunch of lead in there, filled all the way to the top with lead, and you couldn't see that, and I handed it to you, right? So now you're holding a container that weighs maybe 200 pounds. What's going to happen? And I said, don't drop that because we're all going to die. So what are you going to do? You're going to hold it as hard as you can, but it's going to start to rip your muscles, right? The tendons are going to come out of muscles because it's a really heavy weight. But before that happens, the Golgi tendon reflex is going to protect your body. So you grab this really heavy weight that stimulates this Golgi tendon organ, and it sends a massive amount of action potentials to the central nervous system, very high frequency. And it's saying what? Oh, there's a tremendous amount of tension in this muscle. So much so, you're going to damage your body. So what happens is that this sensory neuron from the Golgi tendon organ is going to synapse on an interneuron, and this is a special interneuron because, and here this produces EPSPs at this synapse, but the second synapse is inhibitory because this interneuron is an inhibitory neuron, so it produces IPSPs in this alpha motor neuron. And so what happens? That inhibits this muscle. Action potentials aren't going down to the muscle, so as soon as these Golgi tendon organs realizes that the weight is way too strong, what's going to happen to the your biceps holding up that impossible weight? They're going to relax, and it's just going to fall to the ground. Okay, so that is the Golgi tendon organ reflex, because this interneuron is inhibitory. So how could you explain this inhibitory neuron, this inhibitory interneuron right here? What kind of mechanism might be involved? What's it going to produce in this alpha motor neuron? It's going to produce IPSPs. How do you produce IPSPs typically? Something that opens up a sodium channel? No, something that opens up a potassium channel, causes hyperpolarization, keeps that neuron from reaching threshold. Okay, so the Golgi tendon organ reflex, at least at this interneuron place, link in the reflex is due to producing IPSPs due to potassium channels. All right, so that's probably enough for skeletal muscle. Now we're going to talk about two kinds of muscle that are not under voluntary control. They're under involuntary control. Some of them are a lot different than skeletal muscle internally. All right, so we got one slide right here of cardiac muscle. So let's just quickly think of some characteristics of cardiac muscle compared to skeletal muscle. Is cardiac muscle striated? Yes. What does that mean?
What is
energy? Everything in your body that needs energy requires ATP, so that's sort of the same for cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle. It needs ATP. What are we working on? Similar things? Yeah, similar things. What's similar between cardiac? The arrangement of actin and myosin is arranged so that it forms sarcomeres. Right? So there's a Z disc, and if there's a repeated pattern of sarcomeres, what does that produce when you look at a whole bunch of cardiac muscle? How does it look underneath a microscope if there are sarcomeres? It looks striated. And so does this cardiac muscle look striated to you? Do you see light bands, dark bands, repeating over and over and over and over again? This is true. So we do have sarcomeres in cardiac muscle. But now let's talk about some differences. The skeletal muscle is long, hugely long. It's made up of thousands of progenitor cells, so every muscle fiber has thousands of nuclei in there. What about for cardiac muscle? They're microscopically short. They're only a single cell. They were always just a single cell. So there's one nucleus in every cell. And what else about the structure? Are they long and narrow, like a fiber or a thread? No. They're branched. Okay, they're short and they're branched. So here we see, look at this really weird branching one here. It goes all the way down to here. So this is the end of one cell. Here's the end of one cell. Here's the other end. And this junction between cells is kind of special because each one of these cells right here is going to contract. Right? So, and when it contracts, it needs to pull on its neighboring cell. If it pulls apart, then right, the heart is going to fail. So these cells have to be glued together. So what do we call that junction between cardiac muscle cells that glue the cells together so that they can all pull on each other? That's called an intercalated disc. Okay, intercalated disc. But there's another important component within an intercalated disc related to the way that the heart contracts, and that is that it has gap junctions. And gap junctions that we see right here are sodium channels. So this is a way for sodium to move directly from one cell to the next. So let's just say that this cell has been excited, has been caused to depolarize. What usually happens when a cell depolarizes? What's the molecular event? When a cell depolarizes, what happens? Sodium, what happens to sodium? Does it go out or in? Sodium goes in. Sodium goes in, that causes depolarization. So if this first cell depolarizes, it gets stimulated, sodium goes in, but sodium then can go into the neighboring cell because through the gap junction. And when it moves in through the into the neighboring cell, what happens to the RMP of this neighboring cell? It depolarizes too. It becomes stimulated. So electrical stimulation can flow directly from one cell to another throughout the whole myocardium. So that's a synapse, but that's a special kind of synapse. You're familiar with a chemical synapse, which requires a neurotransmitter. What kind of synapse is this right here? That is, there are two kinds of synapses. The first is chemical and electrical. Here is an example of an electrical synapse. And all cells within the myocardium have electrical synapses, so the myocardium, or the heart, functions together as a unit, which is a really good thing that skeletal muscle doesn't do that, right? Because if we stimulated one muscle, what would happen if all the muscles in your body got stimulated? Well, you'd be very spastic. You couldn't control anything in your body, right? Okay. All right, so, but not only can stimulation or depolarization flow from one cell to another within the same level of the heart, but because the myocytes are branched, what happens to that depolarization? It starts in one level, and it can move down into the next level and even into the next level, causing every distance across the heart wall to contract because these cells are branched and they're connected with electrical synapses in these intercalated discs because of the gap junctions. So the heart contracts in unison as a unit, which is necessary for it to pump blood. Okay, so that's the first impression of the myocardium that you should be aware of. So it still has a sarcomere, it's got Z-discs. Most of the calcium still comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum. Some calcium does come from the extracellular space, because where is calcium higher? In the extracellular space or in the cytoplasm? Extracellular space. So when a calcium channel opens in the cell membrane, it flows into the cell. And in a skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle, what does it bind to? To cause the filaments to start sliding over each other. It binds to troponin, which is a part of actin. It binds to troponin. That moves tropomyosin out of the way, the big long molecule, and now myosin can bind to actin. Okay, so cardiac muscle is similar in that respect. We're going to see there's some differences later on when we get to cardiac muscle. All right, smooth muscle, a much different kind of muscle. Okay, because let's contrast this with skeletal muscle. Let's just visually look at this micrograph right here. These fibers are short. So how many nuclei per cell? Just one. There's just one per cell because they're not long fibers. So they're not long and tubular like a thread. They kind of look like a football that's been stretched out a little bit. It's got two pointy ends. Okay. And you see striations. Okay. You know, I don't see striations in this fiber, in this micrograph right here. All right, I see something that maybe looks a little similar in the illustrations, but if I look in this micrograph, I don't see striations. All right, do you see a repeating pattern? I maybe see some nuclei around over here, but I don't see striations like I do here. All right, so what does that mean in smooth muscle? Does it have a sarcomere? Doesn't have a sarcomere. So you might wonder, well, how on earth does a smooth muscle contract? Well, a smooth muscle contracts because, even though it doesn't have a sarcomere, doesn't have Z-lines and Z-discs, it still has actin and myosin filaments. All right, so here, what is this, blue? Are these little blue lines?
Purple.
Purple? Oh, okay, the purple. The purple or blue lines are actin. Okay, and they're attached not to a Z disc, they're attached to special structures on the cell membrane that we call dense bodies. So they are special attachment points that are on the outside of the cell. Nothing deep inside the smooth muscle cell. They're on the membrane. Okay, and interspersed or interdigitated between the actin molecules are the myosin. So it sort of looks like a sarcomere, except it doesn't have any Z discs to it, right? And this is more of a linear arrangement, like this. But in a myofibril, what's the arrangement of actin and myosin? It's more three-dimensional, right? The myofibril is more three-dimensional, but the actin myosin filaments and smooth muscle is more of a planar kind of element. Okay. Nonetheless, actin and myosin slide over each other, so the sliding filament mechanism works. But when a smooth muscle is triggered into contracting, since it doesn't have Z lines don't come closer together. What comes closer together in a smooth muscle cell? What are the endpoints called? It's the really small text right here that we can hardly see. These are the dense bodies, right? So the dense bodies on the surface of the cell membrane get pulled together. So if you grab the cell membrane at 100 different places and pull it together, that shrinks the cell down. So that's how a smooth muscle contracts, by pulling the cell membrane together. Okay. So it has no sarcomeres. Some smooth muscle tissues have gap junctions between them, some don't. Contains 16 times more actin than myosin, so you have many more actins than you do myosin. This allows for greater stretching as well as contracting. And the actin filaments, like I said, are anchored to these dense bodies. All right, so what about excitation-contraction coupling? Smooth muscle does not contain tropomyosin and troponin, but there still is something that is sensitive to calcium concentration. All right, so calcium still controls the sliding of the actin and myosin filaments together, but in a little bit different way. So smooth muscle really doesn't have any sarcoplasmic reticulum, a reservoir for calcium. So when a smooth muscle gets stimulated, it opens up calcium channels that are right on the plasma membrane. When the calcium channels are open, calcium is high on the outside, it diffuses to the inside of the cell, causing the sliding of these myofilaments, right? But no sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so, but you're familiar with a cousin molecule to troponin. What's the cousin molecule called? Calmodulin. We've heard of calmodulin before. So calcium binds to calmodulin, and that activates something called myosin light chain kinase. So what's myosin? That's this molecule here that has these cross bridges on it. And we can isolate myosin. We can take smooth muscle, grind it up, and pull the myosin out. And then we can separate the different parts of myosin. And some of the parts are heavy. Okay, some of the parts are really light. And so the part that we're interested here is the part that's very light. And you've actually were able to separate molecules out based on how heavy they were at one time, or at least notice their difference in motion when you did a diffusion experiment in lab. One of the very first diffusion experiments, you took two different chemicals. One was real heavy and one was real light. You put a drop on a piece of filter paper, and which one moved faster? Which one diffused faster, the heavy one or the light one? The light one. The lower molecular weight. And I forget if that was the blue one or the brown one, I'm not sure. You did methylene blue and potassium permanganate. And it was the smaller molecule that diffused faster. So you can separate things out by how big or heavy they are. So the part of this myosin that's the smaller part, this head group right here, the light chain, becomes phosphorylated. Because what can you tell me about myosin light chain kinase? What does it do? It adds a phosphate. In particular, where does it add a phosphate to? Myosin. And the part of myosin is the light chain as opposed to the heavy chain on myosin. And when myosin is phosphorylated, it can form cross bridges. with actin, and it can use ATP to articulate, which causes sliding of the myofilaments over each other. Okay, so this calcium calmodulin complex activates the myosin light chain kinase, which phosphorylates myosin, which then causes the filaments to slide over each other. No troponin, no tropomyosin. A different kind of mechanism altogether. Relaxation occurs because the calcium concentration decreases, because there are calcium pumps in the cell membrane that continuously pump calcium outside the cell. And without stimulation, calcium channels don't remain open. And when that happens, another enzyme takes over. We call this myosin phosphatase. What does a phosphatase do? It removes the phosphate, and it removes it from the light chain of myosin. And when myosin isn't phosphorylated, it can't use ATP, it can't bind to actin, and the smooth muscle relaxes as a result of that. And because this is a little bit more involved mechanism, smooth muscle has a slower rate of contraction. It uses ATP much slower, so cross-bridge cycling is slower. But the advantage of that, is that smooth muscle can produce what we call a latched state. Actin and myosin can bind to each other for long periods of time without relaxing, without the use of a lot of energy. So could anybody give me an example of a smooth muscle that needs to contract maybe for months on end without relaxing? Yeah, without relaxing. Then that would be a blockage of your GI tract. You'd be unhappy if that were to happen. You had a torsion or something in your digestive tract. Okay? What about the cervix during pregnancy? Okay, cervix has to contract. It's got to maintain pregnancy for months on end. Okay, so that cervix smooth muscle goes into a latch state and maintains pregnancy. Okay, so that's an example. So, one of the last slides in this chapter, here we have a plot of membrane potential of a smooth muscle cell versus time. And does it look like there is a stable resting membrane potential? Is there a stable RMP right here? What's happening to this particular cell? It looks like it's depolarizing, right? Here you see depolarizing. And then what happens to it? It repolarizes. And then what does it do again? It depolarizes again, and then it depolarizes. And then what does it do again? It depolarizes again. So some smooth muscle is autorhythmic, right? It generates its own stimulus. Okay, so what causes this little slope right here in the membrane potential? What's happening here? What causes depolarization? Sodium is doing what? Going in. So there's a sodium leak channel that's open, right? And it allows some sodium in, and then there are other voltage-gated channels, the sodium channels close, the potassium channel opens, and it repolarizes, right? And then the sodium channels reset, they start to depolarize again because they start to leak sodium, and then this just repeats itself. And these are graded potentials. They slowly increase, and when a graded potential reaches threshold, what happens? Yeah, then the voltage-gated sodium channels really open up, that causes action potentials, and this is what stimulates the muscle to contract. So some smooth muscle is autorhythmic, like in your digestive tract or moving food through your digestive tract. All right, so when there's an action potential in the smooth muscle cell, that triggers the voltage-gated calcium channels to open in the plasma membrane. So they're just voltage-gated calcium channels. And what happens to calcium then? When they open up. Where's calcium high? Outside. It's high outside the cell. When a channel opens, calcium goes inside the cell. Calcium can interact with, in a smooth muscle, what kind of protein? Calmodulin, not troponin, but calmodulin. All right, so here you have a calmodulin-calcium complex. Myosin light chain kinase, when it's inactive, is phosphorylated. But calmodulin-calcium complex will dephosphorylate myosin light chain kinase, and it becomes active. Myosin light chain kinase then will bump into a myosin head group, and it will phosphorylate it. All right, so that requires ATP for that to happen. And when myosin is phosphorylated, that's when cross bridges can start to form between the actin and myosin. And when cross bridges form between actin and myosin, what happened to them? They slide over each other. The muscle contracts. Okay. All right, when the muscle ceases to be stimulated, calcium is pumped out of the cell. Myosin light chain kinase becomes inactive again, right? And there is another enzyme that's always active in the cytoplasm, and that is myosin phosphatase. So what is myosin phosphatase always doing? It's dephosphorylating the myosin light chain, and when it dephosphorylates it, it converts it into an inactive form, and the muscle relaxes, and the skeletal muscle, okay, goes back to its normal resting condition. Okay, it's only when the muscle is contracting that myosin light chain kinase activity is greater than the myosin phosphatase activity. That's when a muscle contracts. So the myosin phosphatase pretty much is always active, but sometimes it's overwhelmed by the amount of myosin light chain kinase that's activated via this calmodulin calcium complex. And also look at myosin phosphatase also switches between an active and an inactive form by what? Phosphorylation. So phosphorylating proteins is used over and over and over again to either activate enzymes or deactivate enzymes, acting as a switch for turning biochemical pathways or processes on and off just by putting a phosphate molecule on an enzyme. So how could you envision why by just putting a phosphate molecule on a protein, how does that change the activity of that protein? It changes the shape because phosphate is a big polar element, and you could think of like me walking up to you and poking my finger in your side. What's going to happen to you? You're going to move. Yeah, I'm going to get an elbow or something in the nose, right? So just by a little point, you can definitely change the conformation of that enzyme, changing the active site, making the lock and key model work much better for its activity. Okay. So smooth muscle has two different major types. There is something called single unit and something called multi-unit smooth muscle. Single unit is spontaneously active. Did we see something that looks spontaneously active? Something that spontaneously depolarizes and repolarizes? Depolarizes and repolarizes because there are different channels that open up for sodium and potassium. We call that a myogenic smooth muscles. Some cells are pacemakers. That means that they can control the rate of depolarization within a whole tissue. We're going to see that that is similar to cardiac tissue as well. And single unit has gap junctions. So what does that mean? When there's gap junctions, if you have a tissue, you have thousands of muscle fibers, that single unit that has gap junctions, if you stimulate one muscle, what happens to that whole group of smooth muscle cells? That action potential will be self-propagating from one cell to the next through those sodium channels, so that whole tissue is going to contract. Okay, so that's single unit. Multi-unit requires nerve stimulation, right? So single unit doesn't require nerve stimulation, but multi-unit does require nerve stimulation. So what part of your nervous system goes to smooth muscles? Is it going to be somatic, or is it going to be autonomic? Okay, somatic, okay. Okay, somatic means voluntary. Somatic nerves go to your skeletal muscles. Autonomic nerves go to cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands, right? So it's going to be autonomic nervous system, right? The neurotransmitter is released not at the axon terminus, but along swellings along the whole length of the axon, which we call varicosities. So with a somatic motor neuron, the swelling is at the axon terminus. That's where you have all the synaptic vesicles. But with an autonomic neuron, you have synaptic vesicles as a group in different locations along a nerve. That swelling is what we call a varicosity, and it kind of looks like a string of pearls or something. And we call those synapses en passant, or synapses in passing. So here we see two different kinds of this smooth muscle. So here is an autonomic neuron sending the axon down. So this would be like the, what neuron would this be? Preganglionic or postganglionic? That's the postganglionic neuron, right? And it's non-myelinated. I don't see any myelin right there. These are the varicosities, which contain neurotransmitters. So when an action potential flows down this axon, this varicosity is going to release neurotransmitters. So is this one. So is this one. On down the line. Neurotransmitter will bind to ligand-gated channels in this smooth muscle cell, causing, of course, calcium to enter. It's going to bind to calmodulin. It's going to depolarize the cell. But look, here we have gap junctions. So what about that depolarization? It's going to go from this cell to this cell to this one, right? And it will go through the whole muscle. And a good example of this would be the digestive tract. So this whole muscle in this region here is going to contract. Okay, it's going to propel food, okay, through the digestive tract. So depolarization can move through these electrical synapses, acting, so it's going to produce a single action in this whole tissue. So we call that single unit smooth muscle. Okay, oops. As opposed to, I'm glad I could go back. As opposed to multi-unit. Here we have multi-unit smooth muscle. Do you see any gap junctions between the cells here? No gap junctions. So each one of these smooth muscle cells can contract independently of any of these others. Again, you have autonomic neurons with varicosities, and each smooth muscle cell in this particular case has to be stimulated by binding a ligand or a neurotransmitter, which is going to open up calcium channels, which is going to cause sliding of the myofilaments. All right, so this example, say for instance, in the ciliary muscle in the eye, what is a ciliary muscle? Well, the pupil controls the pupil. But what about the ciliary body? What does it pull on or release tension on? What's the connection between the lens and the ciliary muscle? That's the suspensory ligament. The suspensory ligament. So it's that muscle that pulls on the lens, changes the shape of the lens. What's the name of that process, and what's it good for? That changes the shape of the lens. You gotta know the name of that process for sure. That is accommodation, right? So that changes the distance that you can focus at. Allows you to focus up close but not far away, or allows you to focus far away but not up close at the same time. That's accommodation. All right, so that's it for this chapter. Oh, it's time to go. But I have a quiz first. I got a quiz first for you guys. Okay? So I have a muscle cell hanging right here. Okay? So here's a muscle cell. And as long as it doesn't fall down, it's going to behave. So what is a muscle cell specialized to do? Contract. It's got to get shorter. All right? So I'm going to make this thing shorten. And I want you to tell me if it's skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, or smooth muscle. And then why? All right, so here's a quiz. Are you ready? Well, let me take that little marker off. Okay. So now this, is it longer or shorter?
Shorter.
It's shorter, and now it's longer. And now it's shorter, so it's contracting, and now it is relaxing. So what kind of muscle cell is that? Is that skeletal muscle or smooth muscle or cardiac muscle? But why?
When it relaxes, it stretches.
But cardiac muscle does that too. Skeletal, you said skeletal?
Yes.
Okay. But when smooth muscle relaxes, it stretches too. It gets longer. So all muscles, when they contract, get shorter, and when they relax, they get longer. Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and skeletal muscle both contract when it's stimulated, and when it relaxes, it gets longer. Well, it could. I could put a weight here. Okay. Oh, what did I hear? I heard something I liked. Dense bodies. Where do you see dense bodies? Okay. Because In skeletal and cardiac muscle, you have Z-discs, right? You see sarcomeres. Do you see sarcomeres here? Not really. You just see this crosshatch pattern. And on the surface of the cell membrane, you have dense bodies. What's connected to the dense bodies? Actin and actin. And when myosin and actin slide over each other, what kind of muscle cell has a dense body again? The smooth muscle, right? So when actin and myosin slide past each other, what, the dense bodies come closer together in smooth muscle. So is that what happens here? Do these points on the surface come closer together? Yes. Okay, so there's nothing sliding on this model, but the important thing I want you to see are these dense bodies on the cell membrane get pulled closer together, and that's an example of a smooth muscle, not a skeletal or cardiac. Okay, because it would be the sarcomeres getting shorter in cardiac and smooth muscle. Okay, so I like the dense bodies on this one right here. Okay, so that's it. Except for the test next time, but next time we'll meet downstairs. Okay? Okay. So unless there's a question, any questions? Okay.